coming up, July 20th, is the anniversary of the first lunar landing. Remember when Neil Armstrong walked? Some of you weren't born. Some of you remember exactly where you were that day. I was in junior high school, summer break, and I remember when we landed on the moon and heard those words from Neil Armstrong, having such pride as an American. I was so proud of our nation that we do such an incredible thing. And I remember, some of you probably remember throughout your life moments where you had these thoughts that came to you and you remember them the rest of your life. And I remember very clearly at that moment I had this thought in my mind was, wow, there isn't anything that we cannot do. Mankind can do anything. If we can do this, if we can land on the moon, if we put our mind to it, if we work together, there's no limit to what mankind can do. Over the next few years, going through high school and beyond, as my sin began to unfold over those years, and as I saw the sin of mankind unfolding, the Vietnam War was in full swing, and all the craziness that came with the late 60s and early 70s. And later, mankind can do anything when it comes to sin. So my motto was, if you can't beat them, join them. And that's what I did. That's what we see in this passage. What we just read was this pride of mankind to be able to do anything and to do it independent of God. And we see how God comes down and busts it all up for their own good. Now, this is the story of how we got all the nations, where all the nations came from. And the background of this is chapter 10, or rather, chapter 11 is the background of chapter 10. Because this is these chapters, 10 and 11, are written thematically. They're not written chronologically. The first verse of chapter 10, verse 1 says this: Now these are the records of the generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and the sons who were born to them after the flood. We saw the flood last week. We saw the covenant that God made with them. We saw how things started to go downhill right away. But this is what became of the sons of Noah. Now it's important to remember that Moses wrote this book. He wrote the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament, of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And he was writing Genesis probably while they were in the desert. And Israel was a brand new nation, newly redeemed from slavery in Israel. They were given the tabernacle as a means of worship. They were given the Ten Commandments. They were given the law. They were given the promise to go into the land. And so when they read this, when they read chapters 10 and 11, this was written for them, for their instruction to understand a number of things. Number one, where did all these nations come from? Because they were in the desert at this time. They just came out of Egypt, and they were told to go into the land where some of these nations are going to be named. Where did all these people come from? It's a huge part for them to understand. What became of the sons of Noah? This demonstrates the origin of the surrounding nations. And ultimately, this is a warning to the nation of Israel of what happens to a nation, to a people, who live independent of God and disobey His commands. Now, what you see on the screen, we're just going to go over this very briefly from chapter 10. But you need to know that all people came from one man, through Noah and his sons. In fact, in Acts, Paul said this when he was in Athens: The God who made the world and all things in it, since He is the Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is He served by human hands as though He needed anything, since He Himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. And He made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth. Even evolutionists will tell you that every person who lives on the earth, they can trace them back to one common female. So this is not some Bible story that is not based in scientific fact. This is scientific fact. All people came from one man. Adam, through Noah, and through his sons. Now, in chapter 10, what Moses does for us as he records the genealogies, it's not just the story of these people, but he talks about the sons of Japheth, the sons of Ham, and the sons of Shem. These are Noah's sons, and he tells how all these nations came from them. The sons of Japheth, you can see in the red shaded area, these are those who settled to the north and to the east. These are the ones, they're separated according to languages, basically. And so all of the Indo-European languages, this is where most of us are from. Over into to Europe and into India, all those languages are related to one another. And they were separated, the sons of Japheth, they basically went north. Now you see then the sons of Ham in the mustard or the yellow portion. Ham was one of the sons of Noah. And the main countries that came from Ham were Cush. Cush, the Cushites known throughout the Old Testament were usually the Ethiopians. Mizraim was Egypt. Canaan, we know all about Canaan, right? And we know that Put, one of the nations, is probably present-day Libya. So we see Egypt and Africa and Libya. Most of these, the sons of Ham settled there and in the land of Canaan. Now Canaan, the Canaanites were going to be a big problem to the Israelites. We know that. In fact, it says, from Canaan came the Jebusites. See the little breakout there, but I'll just read it from the Bible. The Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, the Arvadites, the Semarites, the Hamathites. Afterwards, the family of the Canaanites were spread abroad. So all of these people, God said, you're going to go in and you're going to displace these people. And so when Israel reads Genesis chapter 10, they're going, oh, so that's where these people came from. That's who these people are. Now, there is a bit of a side note in chapter 10. It says, Cush became the father of Nimrod. He became a mighty one on the earth, and he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord, the beginning of the kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, and the land of Shinar. Nimrod says he was a mighty hunter, but most commentators think that he was a hunter of men. And he was mighty before the Lord. He was mighty, it's literally in the presence of the Lord, in the face of the Lord. And it's more like in his face. He was against the Lord. And Nimrod is the one who founded Babylon. And that's the story that we're going to pick up in chapter 11 that we read, the Tower of Babel. Now the sons of Shem, they will be the Semites. You hear of Semitic languages, and they're gathered according to languages. And the sons of Shem are those who lived in this area. And the Ugaritic, Akkadic, Aramaic, Arabic, Hebrew languages, they're all Semitic languages from the sons of Shem. And he became the father of Eber. Actually, Eber was Shem's great-great-grandson. And Eber became the Hebrew people, Eber, Hebrew. So it is through the line of Eber that Abraham will come in the latter part of chapter 11. Also, Eber says two sons were born to Eber. The name of one was Peleg, which means to divide. For in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. So Peleg probably pinpoints for us the story of the Tower of Babel when the nations were spread abroad. So if you look at verses 31 and 32, it says, these are the sons of Shem according to their families, according to their languages, by their lands, according to their nations. They were separated by tribes, they were separated by language, they were separated by geography, they were separated by politics, and this is where all of the nations came from. Now, this is just a brief overview. If you want to know more about it, chapter 10 is very fascinating. Go to Bible.org and look up the table of nations and read there more about it. Verse 32, these are the families of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies, by their nations. And out of these, the nations were separated on the earth after the flood. So that is the background of chapter 11, or rather, chapter 11 is the background of chapter 10, because chapter 11 happens midpoint through chapter 10. So let's look at chapter 11, the story that we read. And what we want to see first and foremost in these first four verses is we see this ongoing arrogance of mankind. Now, the whole earth used the same language and the same words. Now, we know that this happened before chapter 10, because chapter 10 tells us where all the languages came, how they were separated according to language. Chapter 11 is going to tell us how the languages came about. So the whole earth used the same language. So after several generations, the sons of Noah gathered together. They all spoke the same language. There was no reason for them not to. And it came about as they journeyed east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. Always going east. They should not have been going east. We'll tell you about that in just a moment. And they said to one another, now, here's something I didn't realize till I was doing some study. This is full of satire. This story is full of satire, making fun of these people. And they're like a bunch of kids. Hey, let's make some bricks, and let's burn them, and let's put them together, and let's make a big city and a tower, and we can make a name for ourselves. Maybe we can get 1 million likes on Facebook. That's really the idea of what's going on here. This is mankind at his worst, elevating himself. We want to make a name for ourselves. Let's make bricks, and let's burn them together, and let's toast them and burn them, and let's put them together with tar for mortar. We're going to make this city and this tower, this physical manifestation, and it's going to reach into heaven. Really? Really? And we will make a name for ourselves, a reputation, human glory. Now, used to be we talked about secular humanists. This is where it all began. Now it's secular progressives. But the idea is the same. Within humankind, there is this idea for people to live independent of God and make a name for ourselves, for mankind. Look at what we can do. What arrogance and what pride. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Well, what is wrong with that? Well, we see, first of all, man's pitiful attempt to reach heaven based upon his own effort by making bricks. By the way, the Israelites would read this later. In later generations, after they made the temple of God out of cut stone, they would read this and they would smile and they'd go, making bricks for a religious temple. Look at the temple of Solomon, they would say later on. And they would laugh at this. And they wanted to make their name great. I was just reading through 2 Chronicles recently, and over again, as they're building the temple, it talks about to make the name of the Lord great. The name of the Lord is the glory of God. And so mankind here is robbing God of his glory. Their error is this. They sought to live independent of God. Second of all, they sought religion apart from God. They just excluded him from the whole thing. And lastly, they directly disobeyed the command which was given to Adam and Eve, which was given to Noah and his sons, to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Because it said in Genesis 1:28, God said to Adam and Eve, God blessed them, and he said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Then he said to Noah and his sons, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And what do we see in chapter 11 of Genesis? We don't want to be scattered. We want to stay together. We want to build a city. We want to build a tower. We want to build a monument to ourselves. We want to just be together. We want to have a one world government. And so they did. And they tried to stay together, but they were directly disobedient to God. Now, what they were building was a ziggurat. What you see on the screen is the temple of the moon god Sin, S-I-N. This is in Ur. I took this in 2003. Built about 2100 B.C. So they built this temple, this ziggurat, to the moon god Sin, or Sin. And there was a curator who was there. It was interesting because we were in the middle of a war, and he was protecting the place and told us all about it, and it was quite a fantastic thing. Part of those outside walls were reconstructed by Saddam Hussein, because Saddam Hussein saw himself as somewhat the reincarnation of Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. And so he was rebuilding this temple. The moon god, when you see today the sign of Islam with the crescent moon, it comes from here. Notice the bricks and the mortar. They used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. That's exactly what they did here as well. Now, this is just south of Ur. I mean, this is in Ur. This is just south of Babylon, not too far. But see, this is left over. When the Bible says they used brick and they used tar for mortar, that's exactly what they were building. This is right near the plains of Shinar. Curator showed us these stones, and on every one of these stones was an inscription dedicated to the moon god Sin. Every single brick had that inscription on it. This next slide is actually a picture of part of the walls of the city of Babylon, which is left of it today. And you can see back in the background, the little jagged part, that's part of Saddam's rebuilding of the city of Babylon. Man always lifting himself up in his pride. Even though this was all torn down for centuries, Saddam thought he could build it up and could become a god himself. So this is exactly what they were doing in Babylon. They were building this giant ziggurat to reach into heaven. Now, here's some lessons for us. Pride is living one's life independent of God. And that's exactly what these people were doing. They excised God from the equation. They didn't consult him. They didn't include him. And yet it wasn't that long ago that he had made a covenant with them. And they wanted to live without him. You think, well, that's not my lot. I love the Lord. I'm here today, right? I'm worshiping. I'm not living independent of God. I try and read my Bible on a regular basis, and I pray when I can. But remember what we see in the book of James. Don't just be hearers of the word, but be doers of the word. Don't be like the man who looks at his face in the mirror, and when he walks away, he forgets what kind of man he is. We need to allow God to inspect our lives, and we need to take what we learn on Sunday mornings and what we learn in our Bible reading, what we learn in our prayers, and we need to live them throughout the day. The purposes of the disciplines of the Christian life is godliness. In other words, the Bible reading and worship and fellowship and prayer, they lead to godliness. But we can do every one of those mechanically, can't we? I attend church. I checked the box. I prayed a list. Even Israel later on would say, God would say to Israel, these people, they draw near to me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. We don't want to live independent of God. We can read our Bibles and we can pray, and then we can live the rest of the day in independence from God, just as if he didn't exist. Sound familiar? Second of all, the logical outcome of living independent of God is godless rebellion. We see that in the scriptures. Even those who claim to know God, when they begin to live independent of him, pretty soon they go down this track, and pretty soon they're actually living godless lives. No one sets out to be godless. No Christian ever sets out to be godless. But we've all known the seemingly perfect Christian woman, seemingly perfect Christian man, who just walked away from God. We've all seen it happen. How does it happen? It happens by someone who is living independent of God, and pretty soon that independence of God turns into godless rebellion. Let's be warned about that. And third, it's important that we work hard to avoid generational failure. I see this as a generational failure. It wasn't that long ago that the covenant was made with Noah and his sons. It didn't take long for people to forget God, did it? It takes energy on our part to produce generations of righteousness. Your cute little three-year-old who says cute little things may not always be so cute. And it's wrong to think that just because she's cute today, she's always going to be that way. Those of you who have raised kids, you know what I'm talking about. Because sin has its effect. And children are beautiful when they're small and they're innocent, but we live in a world that is infected with sin, and we have to avoid generational failure because it takes effort and energy to produce a godly generation. Generational righteousness, rather, does not come naturally. Sin comes naturally. God expected these people to obey His word, and He expected them to pass it on to the next generation. He said, okay, Noah, Japheth, Ham, Shem, pass it on. Pass on the faith. And here we are a few generations later. Where is God? They forgot so fast. How quickly and easily we can forget God. We can forget Him over generations, or we can forget Him in a day. So it's important for us to always be working hard to walk with God and to keep Him ever before us. And this was a caution to the Israelites when they would read this. This is a nation. These people, they had everything going for them. Many of them had seen the flood, the effects of the flood, the sons of Noah, and they did not pass on the faith. And this is a warning for us as well. We are a multi-generational church, and we want to continue to be a generational church where we pass on the faith from generation to generation to generation, and we have to be careful that we do pass on the faith and we don't botch the handoff. We need to do that. We have great examples of that at Valley Bible Church. We have many families with young kids who are doing a fantastic job of raising their children. And we have those who are raising their adult children and working into their lives. And I think of the Snooks. I think of the Apostle Paul, Paul Murray here, over here. consistently working into the lives of his children, and many of you as well. We see generations of fathers and sons and grandchildren here at Valley Bible Church. We want to make sure that we keep that generational righteousness moving because it will naturally just fade away if we don't fan the flame. And that's what happened here. The next thing we see in the story is the omniscient attention of God. Verse 5, I love it. It's satire. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. Did God really have to come down to see? It's kind of like the angels. Hey, God, did you hear what the people are doing on the earth? They built a city and a tower. Really? I need to go down and take a look. And he gets down on his hands and his knees and he goes, oh, there it is, that little nub right there. Is that what you're talking about? Little nub above the earth. A couple hundred feet high, reaching into the heavens, eh? I don't think so. God didn't need to come down to see what they were doing. Isaiah 40, got to be my favorite chapter in the Bible. Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket. That's where we get that idea, drop in a bucket. and are regarded as a speck of dust on the scales. Behold, he lifts up the islands like fine dust. Even Lebanon is not enough to burn, nor its beasts enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless. This is the greatness of our God. And these people thought, oh, we are going to make for ourselves a name and a tower that will reach into heaven. No, you're not. Didn't make it. Didn't even come close. Psalm 2. Why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand. The rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. And that's what was happening here. I'm sure he was looking a little fatherly chuckle. Are you kidding me? This is your tower reaching into heaven? No. But God was paying attention. No one had to call his attention to this. He was watching because he is always watching. And he was watching then and he is watching now, which gives us a lesson. God is directly involved in our lives. For us as believers, even more so because we are the redeemed. We are the ones that he's chosen to be his children. And he knows everything about you. He knows the hairs on your head. He knows how many went down the shower this morning. He knows every word before you say it. He knows the days of your life. He knows how many days you will live. He knows the moment of your birth. He knows the moment of your death. And that's not a bad thing. He gives attention to what we do in a positive way. He scrutinizes what we do. And so the lesson for us, when we see that the Lord was paying attention and he was scrutinizing this tower in a way that he will bring judgment upon them, but for us, he scrutinizes our lives and he is watching and he always is watchful and careful of us and for us because he cares about us. Yes, he cares about the evil in the world, but he cares even more so for us, for we who are his believers. Second of all, God is not impressed with human efforts to reach heaven. Never was, never will be, nor should we. We should not be impressed with ourselves. We should not be impressed with religious superstars. We should not be impressed with how much praying someone does or how many good works someone does. They fell far short. Just like these people, no matter what they did, they were no closer to God than when they began, were they? They were right where they started. They built this tower, and once the tower was built, they hadn't moved an inch. They had not moved the dial. Nor can we. It's folly to believe that we can reach God by virtue of human effort, the things that we do. And every other religion in the world espouses that. That this is how you reach God. This is how you reach heaven. You got to be good. You got to follow the rules. You got to join this religion. You got to do the deeds. And if you do, maybe you might be good enough. No. And why? Because they started with an improper view of God, didn't they? They started with an improper view of God like he's the moon or the sun. And if we just build a tower high enough, he's got to be right there, huh? What a paltry view of the God of the universe, the creator that we have seen in our series so far. God is great and God is beyond our wildest imaginings. And the motivation for human religion is always self-promotion. It is fame for oneself. It is a name for oneself. I always like to ask Mormon missionaries, well, why do you do what you do? Well, because we love people and the Savior commanded us. No, why are you personally doing what you're doing? Because the ultimate answer is, if you bring it to its logical conclusion, it's for me. I do all that I do for me, that I might make it to heaven and exaltation. We would never do that, would we? Serve God and worship and do all that we do for ourselves, for a name for ourselves, that God might smile upon us or that he might in some way accept us a little bit more? No. You see, man wants the glory, and self-promotion always robs God of his glory. And we are all about the glory of God. The glory of God is the issue of everything that we do at Valley Bible Church, or at least it should be, that all that we are doing is for his glory and not for ours. Not for ours. We don't want to make a name for ourselves or for our church or for any of our pastors. We want to make his name great. We want to magnify his name and bring glory to his name, not us. And that's what they failed to do. In verses 6 through 9, then, we see the corrective compassion of God. The Lord said in verse 6, "Behold, there are one people, and they all have the same language, and this is what they began to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them." Now, what do you think God had in mind when he said that? Did he think, well, man, they might be able to put a man on the moon, or they might cure cancer, or they might figure out how to travel faster than the speed of light? That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about sin unabated. That in their arrogance, there is no limit to what they can do. There is no limit to how bad they can be. And so God is the gracious restrainer of sin in this world. And we, his people, and the presence of God is the only thing that holds this world from just blowing up because of sin. It's bad enough already, and it's getting worse all the time. But were it not for the presence of God and his people, it'd be over with. Because apart from his restraining influence, there is no limit to what man can do. So he says in verse 7, "Come, let us go down and let us confuse their language so that they will not understand one another's speech." This is reminiscent of the end of chapter 3 when we see the Trinity, the plurality of God speaking here. Because in chapter 3, verse 22, "Then the Lord God said, Behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. Now he might stretch out his hand and take from the tree of the life and eat and live forever in his sin. So let's get rid of him. Let's excommunicate them from the garden." And that's what God did for the good of mankind, that he would not eat of the tree of life and forever be in his sin. And so what God is doing here is merciful and compassionate. He's going to bust this thing up for their own good. Verse 8, "So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city, the ruins of which may still be around Babylon today. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth." Interesting wordplay. In verse 9, Babel is played off the Hebrew word Balel, which means confusion. And Babylonian accounts tell that there was a city built in heaven by the gods, proudly referring to it as Babeli, the gate of God. But God says, "You want to make a name for yourself? How about confusion? Your name is a joke. Your name is a joke." They were named Confusion. But this will be turned around in time. Zephaniah 3:9 says, "For at that time I will change the speech of the peoples to a pure speech, that all of them may call upon the name of the Lord and serve him with one accord." One day things are going to return as they should be. The day of Pentecost is as seen by many scholars as also a taste of God restoring and bringing back the nations once again. Each one was hearing them speaking in his own language, which was a reversal of Babel, and a sign that the last days were upon us, where anyone who calls upon the name of the Lord can be saved, regardless of nation and tongue. In the book of Revelation, we see this, and he carried me away in the Spirit to a great high mountain and showed me the holy city Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God. By its light will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it, and its gate will never be shut by day, and there will be no night there. They will bring in it the glory and the honor of the nations. One day, God will restore all the nations together. But in the meantime, Babylon has become the example, has become the archetype, the design of all kingdoms and nations and cities that exalt themselves apart from God. Babylon. Pride and arrogance. That's what's happening in the meantime. A couple of lessons. I think we know this. There is no end to the evil mankind can achieve, but God graciously restrains us. God sometimes takes drastic measures to keep us from the end and the ultimate consequences of disobedience in this world. God is gracious in stopping us and stopping mankind from doing what we want. And who knows what he has put the kibosh on throughout the centuries. Second of all, sometimes our greatest prayer is, Lord, save me from myself. Because I've become independent and self-aware and self-sufficient and proud and therefore godless. So sometimes we should just come to God and say, God, please save me from myself, that you, please don't let sin go on unabated in my life. Please restrain it. Third, God's discipline for them and for us is both punitive and preventative. He was warning them. It was punitive because he was stopping this, but it was also a warning to Israel again, as they would read this. This is what happens to nations who are arrogant against God, and it's a warning to us as well that we, if we ever think that we can live independent of him, if we ever think that we don't need him, if we get too comfy and too cozy and too familiar and proud of our own religious accomplishments, there could be discipline. Now here's a final note here. The story of the fall in the garden and the story of the flood, they both end with hope. At the end of the fall, God gives the promise of a deliverer to Eve. At the end of the flood, God gives a covenant with Noah and a rainbow. But here, after this, the reader is left with the question, well, what is going to happen next? Because there's no hope at the end. This is the last event in primeval history. Creation, fall, flood, the nations. And this is the transition story to the patriarchs, particularly the story of Abraham, where the road to redemption really begins. And that's what we'll begin to see next week. I'll tell you a story of two Gordons. One commentator that I was reading told the story of a guy named Gordon Hall. I'd never heard of him before. And he was quoting an article in the Arizona Republic. And the title of the article was this: Behold, Gordon Hall's Millions Shall Make Him a God. January 17th, 1986. And it says in part this: It is dusk. Gordon Hall stands at an overlook on his 55,000-square-foot mansion in Paradise Valley, a structure built by Pittsburgh industrialist Walker McCune, and now owned and being renovated by Hall. He is 32 years old and a millionaire many times over. He stares at the range of light stretching before him from horizon to horizon and breathes a deep, relaxed sigh. The lights of the city are like the campfires of a great army to Hall, who sees himself as its benevolent general. They are like the flashlights of the world's fortune seekers, and Hall is their beacon to riches. They are, for Hall, like the stars of the firmament, and he is above them all. He is worth more than 100 million, he says, because it was his goal to be worth more than $100 million before the age of 33. There are other goals. By the time he is 38, he will be a billionaire. By the time his earthly body expires and he is convinced he can live to be 120 years old, he will assume what he believes to be his just heavenly reward. Gordon Hall will be a god. He says, we have always existed as intelligences, as spirits, he says. We are down here to gain a body. As man is now, God once was, and as God is now, man can become. That is, by the way, is a quote of Lorenzo Snow, who was one of the presidents of the LDS Church. I don't think Gordon Hall was a Mormon, but he certainly was espousing Mormon theology. And he goes on to say, and I believe it, I can become a god. That is why I believe I can do anything. My genetic makeup is to be a god. My God in heaven creates worlds and universes. I believe I can do anything too. And God laughs, right? So I read this story and I thought, I never heard of this guy. It's 1986. I wonder what became of him. So I did a search. Gordon Hall. He's in prison. Really, he's in prison for fraud and tax evasion and all sorts of things. He's in his 60s now, and he's going to be in prison for 20-some-odd years. So I went back to read some more, and I clicked another link on Gordon Hall, and I saw Gordon Hall, the second Gordon Hall, born in 1784 and died in 1826. He went to Andover Theological Seminary. He was ordained with Adoniram Judson, Samuel Mills, Samuel Newell, Samuel Knott, and Luther Rice. He was the founder of the Bombay Mission for the first American overseas mission station in the world at Bombay. He wrote a work called The Conversion of the World, where he and Samuel Newell proposed a strategy whereby 30,000 missionaries could reach every person on earth. And he said this, it is the duty of Christians to send forth preachers in sufficient numbers to furnish the means of instruction to the whole world. One Gordon Hall embodied the spirit of Babel, pride, self-focus, godlessness. And the other Gordon embodied the spirit of the Great Commission, making disciples of all nations who have been dispersed because of sin to bring them home with the hope of the gospel.